This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, brought to you by Gold Rock Capital. Each week, we look at how high net worth families can improve their lives, decisions, and investments in a deeply uncertain world. We always aim to provide practical information, even if we can't offer specific investment advice. Welcome to the Definitely Uncertain podcast. My name is Darren Rockman, and I'm a partner at Gold Rock Capital, the 21-year-old multifamily office servicing high net worth families in Israel and around the world. And today, coming to us from Washington, D.C., Chris Ekimov. Hi, Chris.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning or good afternoon, as we Chris is a director in the financial investigation and disputes practice at RSM USA, which is actually a global accounting firm. Apart from that, Chris is the co-host of Insecurities, which is a podcast that examines securities, rules, regulations, and also questions of fraud. And he's been called numerous times as an expert witness in whistleblowing cases, SEC cases, and all things fraud-related. And because this is an issue which affects so many people, particularly in the high-net-worth world, we asked Chris to come on to the show and talk a little bit about the world of fraud and how we can maybe protect ourselves and avoid it. So Chris, let me start off like this. As a forensic accountant, just sort of tell me what it is that you do.
So I like to think of forensic accountants as interpreters. You know, I draw a line between what I'll call a translator of a foreign language and what an interpreter of a foreign language is, right? So a translator is someone who looks at the word in the foreign language and translates its exact meaning to the current language or the language it needs to be in. An interpreter might add some context, why a certain phrase might be used in a different language or what these words really mean. A forensic accountant is just that, but with financial information. We'll tell you the debits and the credits, but also we'll look at issues related to why certain transactions happened or what type of structure is around a business or an investment that might make more sense because of our background in it. So I deal with things as exciting or maybe as scary as fraud investigations or regulatory enforcement, both here in the US and globally, but also just tough business issues. You know, say the administrative building that you run your office out of burned down. You know, how do we put the financial statements back together? We're not going to have perfect information in that group. So how do we look at things with a critical lens and try to be intelligent and interpret what that financial information might tell us about the business? So it's not always as exciting as fraud, but it really is answering those questions and interpreting financial information for our clients and for those in the market.
Okay. So what do the numbers mean? That's great. So you're somebody that spends a lot of time looking at cases of fraud, thinking about cases of fraud, talking about it. So I want to start with a sort of general question. You know, whether it's, you know, social media accounts being hacked or, you know, the email from the, you know, Nigerian prince that's just looking to find a safe place for his $25
million. That's right.
You know, so often we're seeing things which are just too good to be true. Why is it that these really simple scams are still so effective at entrapping people?
I'm not a social psychologist, but I do follow a few on Twitter. I think that scams like this work because humans are built or have evolved to trust each other, first and foremost. Right. If you've read the book Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari, that's kind of one of the tenets of how we've developed as a society is trust first. Because that's how we escape from the dangers of the savannah, or that's how we build a shelter together to make sure we can survive. So that latent trustworthiness continues on, you know, across how we look at our professional lives, how we might invest in something, or whether or not we think that, you know, our great aunt across the ocean really is sending us a link to her vacation photos. I've got an aunt who does that all the time. I know if I click that link, it's the Google Drive with the photos. If I had an uncle who sent that to me, who I knew didn't do that a lot, I would look at it differently, right? So I'm trusting that to be out there. So those scams, those schemes, I feel bad for all the actual Nigerian princes out there who are just trying to email their friends.
Yeah, because that is of them just, you that's know, right. Just waiting for some help.
And that's true. I mean, you talk about social media as well. It can be hard to understand what you're exposing yourself to or what information is available out there. There's a great cryptocurrency matter at which social media helped crack the case back 4 or 5 years ago, because the way in which they were tweeting out the links to, you know, get free Bitcoin or exchange your money for Bitcoin led back to the wallets that these fraudsters were utilizing. So yes, it is scary and there are scams out there, but these tools may also provide ways to investigate and follow the money when it comes down to it.
So what you're saying is, you know, as I was told by a crusty old lawyer from London not so long ago, you can only be defrauded by somebody that you trust.
That's right.
So we need to we need to put our trust in somebody, which then exposes us. But if you look at some of the sort of more high profile, you know, newspaper fraud cases, you know, the Madoff case, Theranos, which is something that you spent a long time working on, you know, how did those sort of big cases differ from the sort of email scams and phishing scams? And maybe we should define what phishing is, that you know, so many of us are subject to.
Yeah, I'll answer the question first. They don't differ that much. And I'll talk about why they're not that much different from that Nigerian prince email. Email phishing, right, is where you get a message, whether from a legitimate email address or an address that might be what we call spoofed, in which it appears to be the address of the CFO that you're working with or one of your business collaborators, but it's not, asking you to click a link or do something like change the banking information for your next payment or get involved with another way of doing business that's outside the norm. So if we look at fraud as a whole, you know, I'm not an attorney. Maybe that crusty old lawyer in London might have a good definition too, but fraud to me, and we can think about it generally, is either leaving out key information or providing key information that is false to solicit a reaction or an action from someone to do something they otherwise wouldn't do, right? So that email phishing scheme, I'm not normally going to go change the bank records of one of my vendors to receive payment, but that email with false information that may say, we need payment now, we're about to go bankrupt and you guys are 65 days behind, I might feel pressured to immediately respond and make that payment to a new account when, you know, maybe I shouldn't have done that otherwise. If you raise that up to the level of those headline cases you named, it really comes down to that drive, that pressure, that relationship. Madoff was famous for using the air of exclusivity in soliciting new investments. It's, listen, guys, I've got another fund I'm opening up this year. I've already got 100 investors. You know, John and Steve, they're friends of yours. I need $5 million by Friday or the fund's going to close and you're going to miss out on this opportunity. So again, that air of exclusivity or speed in response from folks really leads to the chance to kind of do away with the regular due diligence or research you would do into investment because you don't want to miss that opportunity. Theranos was similar. And I really think, and this is my personal opinion, that there was a lot of an attempt to create a product that would change the world, right? This was not the, I've got the hot new investment out there for you and it's going to be great. And then you never invest in anything and you run away with the money. I think management of Theranos was really trying to do something. That line probably got blurry, you know, back in the early 20-teens when the technology and for all the ways it's been covered wasn't able to perform to the level they wanted to. So their solicitation of investment was also, we are the hot tech startup in Silicon Valley and we're going to change the world. And if you don't get your $100 million in now, you're going to miss out on this kind of ground level investment, and you're going to be, you know, kicking yourself 5 years from now when we take over the medical world. So again, I think that pressure to get involved, those ways of using exclusivity or specialty, is something that drives investors or drives people to participate. You know, we all want to feel special. We all want to feel a part of something. And when there are these large potential, you know, world-changing events that folks are being asked to contribute money towards, that can be as much of a pull as, you know, the actual financial return that might be promised as well.
So either we're being pandered to, or we're somehow being put into a position of stress in a way that reduces the natural guards that we put up against, you know, people who are either strangers or, you know, people that, you know, otherwise are outside of our immediate circle and therefore we're less likely to trust.
Yeah, I look at it similar to, you know, like many of us 20 years ago when the World Series of Poker took off. We all thought we were going to be the next great poker player, right? So I remember going to a casino and sitting down at the table you know, with a small amount of money for a small stakes table and looking around and realizing that I was by far the worst player at the table, right? I played online for a couple hours the week before, right? So looking around and being like, if I don't understand this, if I think that I'm in the worst position, I shouldn't be putting my money in the table, right? I'm going to lose. Either I'm not going to have the right cards or I'm going to get beat by folks who know the game better than I do. Right. And that's where that, you know, we get away from kind of the due diligence and the research side of it, but sometimes folks are just fooled, right? And they don't have enough information to even know what they should be asking, but they want to get involved. They want to take that checking account or that savings account money they've had for years or that inheritance they got from a relative and put it to good use or get some return on that. And they're not really thinking or have enough knowledge to think about where they're putting their money and how that might impact them in the long term, or God forbid, if that's a fraudulent event.
Right, right. Not everybody falls for scams, and some people seem to have a better natural ability to filter out, you know, or maybe to identify these problem areas. Why is that?
Well, the shortest answer is they've been cheated in the past, right? That's usually, you either
it's the old adage that the definition of a conservative is a liberal who's been mugged, right?
That's part of it too. So I think that, you know, those frameworks that we build in our minds are helpful to drive our understanding of what we might be exposed to. So I've been doing this for almost 20 years. Even I, you know, when I'm interviewing potential fraudsters that are related to an internal investigation, I've got to put my antennas up, right? Even though I've done this hundreds of times, really understanding the story and the focus is different. Was working on a case a few years ago where we had identified an employee of a major organization who seemed to be running his personal travel expenses through a vendor account, and then the company was paying the vendor the full amount. Right. So we had flights, we had social media posts of the places that he had gone to, we had all of the reimbursements on there, and we were ready. I was ready to put handcuffs on him, right? He had stolen almost five figures value from the company over time. Okay. We sat down with him with all the source documents and said, John, what happened here? And he said, well, I know it wasn't right, but the vendor actually told me to do this because they wanted me to feel good. So when the next contract came up, I would award it to them and not look anywhere else. And so that was kind of a gobsmack moment for me to say, I thought that I had him dead to rights, right? We had all the perfect timeline, but the context there was different. So was it a fraud? Maybe, but different in the way that we approached it because we had thought that this was an individual defrauding the company and not some broader scheme or broader, you know, issue coming up there. So being exposed to those types of events helps you calibrate the questions you need to ask and the information that you should provide.
Right. But hopefully so many people aren't. It's always the first time. You know, I would say to clients, you know, when you're doing a one-time transaction, you're always at a disadvantage because very often the person on the other side has done this transaction many more, you know, buying a house, getting a mortgage. You're at a disadvantage. The mortgage giver does this every day. You're going to do this once, maybe twice. So in the absence of having been scammed, God forbid, how do you build those antennae?
Yeah, Darren, my favorite example of that is, you know, I'm happily married, been married for 3 years now, but I only bought an engagement ring once, right? These people are selling engagement rings every day. So they know exactly how to work me for the right price and all that. But that information asymmetry is an important part of it too. I would encourage everybody to be rude. Be rude. That's right. Ask for extra information. Approach things, you know, with the idea that you might lose the money that you're looking to invest or you might be scammed instead of one of that kind of trust we talked about earlier. Folks who are telling the truth and are operating a business that you should invest in will easily be able to respond to your rudeness. You know, show me the past 3 years financials. Okay, I'll email them to you later today. End of story. Show me the past 3 years financials. Well, you know, there were different time periods and we went through this extreme growth, so they're not really valuable. You start to hear those answers and it's a little bit different. So when we're talking about investing for a lot of the folks that I know you work with and you listen to this podcast, be rude. You know, this is your investment. This is your money that you're considering putting towards a cause or an effort that's important to you. Ask the questions that you would ask of anyone that you know you don't trust or maybe wasn't referred to you by a friend. That rudeness, you know, you get over it very quickly. and you become comfortable with it. And the people you work with don't call it rudeness, right? They call it asking the right questions. And so if you can get past that politeness, that's a really great thing to do to start to ask the right questions.
Right. I had a personal situation about 3 years ago where I got a phone call from an insurance company, one that I actually work with. And the guy on the other end, having called me, said to me, could you please give me your ID number? In Israel, we have identification numbers. So I said, well, how do I know who you are? So he said, what do you mean? I'm from the insurance company. So I said, well, you called me. I don't know who you are. Yeah. You're asking personal information. Eventually, I said to him, I will call the switchboard and I will ask to speak to you. He said, well, nobody's ever done that before. I said, well, I'm going to do it.
That's great. Yeah, getting that kind of, I like to call it that outward connection, right? So maybe you do get an email from a vendor that says, change our banking information. Right. Call them directly. You know, you've got an investment advisor who says, hey, deal with my, you know, my money manager in this specific field or talk to my administrator in this field. Call back that money manager directly and say, hey, John, we've been working together for 30 years. You're now telling me to call Stacy. Great. Just want to confirm with you. I'll see you on the golf course in 2 weeks, right? You can have those personal conversations besides those calls out of the blue. And that's something too. A lot of people get scammed because they're getting yelled at on the phone by some regulator or government person or banker that they've never heard of before. And they would rather just make it go away, right? That's another scam that's very popular, especially here in the States with robocalling and things like that, where you just get 50 phone calls a day saying, pay me now, pay me now. Mm-hmm. You'd rather send them $150 and be done with it than actually look into it. That can be a tough one too.
Right. Okay. So be rude. Not usually.
That's right. Officially, our advice for the podcast. Everybody go out and be rude, and then the world will be a great place.
Exactly. And when you get punched,
That's right. Leave it in the comments below the podcast.
And this does not apply to members of your immediate family. You should not be rude to them.
Deal with your family as you see fit. That's all we can say.
Okay. So there are some new markets. That have been opening and developing. You know, we can talk about crypto. Mm-hmm. We can talk about NFTs. Something we've talked about here on the podcast in the past. When you think about those markets, and obviously they tend to be the ones there. What it's the Wild West. You know, there are people gunslinging in the streets and shooting at the sheriff and all that. You know, how much cynicism and skepticism and rudeness should we have when we're looking at those markets?
I think you have to consider kind of how you're prepared to interact with those markets, right? Some people look at it as a casino. Hey, you know, I think this Bitcoin or this Ethereum thing might take off someday, but I'm not 100% sure. So I'm going to put $100 towards it and see what happens. You know, the same way you'd go to a slot machine on vacation if you're in the Caribbean or something like that. Right. That's one way to view it. If you are a true believer in the use of digital currency or non-fungible tokens going forward, then you might approach it differently, right? You may want to do some more research and be a little bit more strategic in how you're utilizing your assets to fund this business. I don't know where they're all going. I don't know if anybody actually knows if, you know, will Bitcoin be the universal currency of the entire world? Doesn't look that way right now, right? There's very limited ways you can utilize Bitcoin outside of the regular kind of Bitcoin uses online.
Right.
So I don't know if there's ever going to be a straight change over to, you know, NFTs taking over the art market or some other kind of hard or you know, tangible asset market that's being memorialized on the ledger with these non-fungible tokens. So I would do a little bit of self-assessment and self-awareness around what you're willing to put towards these ideas that maybe you only have a limited understanding of, the same way you wouldn't invest in a country you'd never heard of or never been to. If you've never, you know, done any research into Bitcoin or into an NFT, maybe think about being a little bit more cautious and a little bit more focused on the strategy and how you want to spend your funds and put your assets toward that, instead of just, oh my God, I read about NFTs on Reddit. Now I've got to get involved. Okay, maybe that's step one, but think about the dollars you're putting towards it and what it's going to mean to you long-term. I've got a friend who's got an NFT of, and I don't know if you're familiar with the movie Ghostbusters, but they have that, they've got the Ecto-1, right? That that car. And so he paid a couple $100 for a digital version of the Ecto-1, and he likes to like put it in his driveway and send us a funny photo. And to him, that's great. I don't think he thinks it's going to be a $100,000 NFT at any point, but he's using that as just kind of a sense of enjoyment and to kind of see where the market's going with those. So that is a great use. Again, maybe not the best return is having a bunch of funny pictures of, you know, parking it by the beach and telling your friends you just drove it to the beach.
Right. But,
you know, that type of idea, you know, approaching it with that curiosity and that interest, you should obviously limit the amount of money you're utilizing when you do that, right, because you don't want to spend $100 million on an Ecto-1 NFT from Ghostbusters if all
probably
you're going to do. That's
probably
right.
Not.
Someone probably has, and I hope they're getting $100 million of enjoyment out of it.
So, you know, when we talk now about sort of the high net worth market, and mm-hmm. you know, clearly in the high net worth market, because of the amounts involved, and because of the, you know, the potential payoff for scammers and fraudsters, the level of sophistication in these scams tends to be higher. You know, we talked about phishing before, which is when you get an email from someone pretending to be someone else. You know, high net worth people are subject to spear phishing, which is where, you know, they sort of watch your email traffic
yep.
and they try and craft an email that you're more likely to sort of click on that link or mm-hmm. provide information. So how do high net worth people become better at detecting these types of scams and frauds before it's too late?
In my view, often family offices or high net worth individuals are victims of their own success, right? They've either, you know, working with family money or had a great idea that took them to the tops of kind of the wealth bracket and now put them in a different position.
Right.
That good idea or that family inherited money did not come with all of the trappings of a successful business, say. Right, it did not grow through these pains and issues that come with building a business. Oftentimes, many family offices have, but on the other end of the spectrum, you're missing the infrastructure. You don't have the cybersecurity protections that are needed for managing hundreds of millions of dollars. If you look at, you know, the investment banks and wealth managers across the globe, they've all learned over the past 100, 150 years how to manage and protect the money that they're being entrusted to. When you're a family office and you've got six employees and you're working out of an office downtown, you might not be thinking about it the same way that some of the largest investment managers in the world are, but you should be, right? Being able to protect yourself and protect those funds against even the mistakes that are made, you know, as you're looking to invest or you're clicking on that email we keep coming back to. Right. I think that puts the high net worth individuals in a position for rapid maturity that'll be very beneficial, right? If you're spending, if you're, you know, looking to invest and utilize $100 million, and you're spending $1,000 a month on cybersecurity, maybe turn that up a little bit, right? To protect that money and to be more a part of it. Cause that's the nest egg that you want to keep and that you want to carry with you.
Right.
The other thing about high net worth individuals, at least in my experience, is they're surrounded by good people and they trust those people inherently. Unfortunately, as Darren, I'm sure you know, people often make mistakes. And maybe are pressured to, you know, get that next deal done or to look good on the next quarter's announcement and be incentivized, maybe not from a personal financial gain or God forbid an embezzlement, but incentivized to create an environment where they're either cutting corners or not asking the right questions.
Right.
That's something else that structure and that procedure can help. So having a checklist for any new investment or having a waiting period when you're approached you know, from a new potential, you know, source or new potential place for you to put your money, wait 3 months, wait 6 months. If that business is still around and still wants, you know, your investment, great. You've done your research. You've cooled off a little bit. You're not subject to that hot and heavy kind of, we got to get in now discussion. Right. So those kind of systems, and I say systems, it's not just technology. Sometimes it's that process. It's that checklist. It's multiple authorizations on any kinds of investments that a high net worth individual might get involved with. Anything that helps you slow down and think clearer is going to be beneficial in the long term, as well as potentially even in the short term from a protection perspective.
Okay. So that's been amazing. And if I can summarize that maybe into sort of five bullet points, which mm-hmm. I'd say, you know, parroting back what you've said to us, be rude,
yep.
be informed, go slower. Don't be in a rush to, you know, to get the next hot deal. Always be a little bit skeptical and set good processes when you're, doesn't matter whether you're, you know, the way you're saving passwords or the way you make it.
Yeah. It's a lot easier to look back and say, you know what, we got fooled, right? We had 13 steps in our process and they lied to us on step 11. That's sometimes it's easier to go to bed at night, even if you lost $10 million, right? You say, hey, you know, we've got our best protection in place. It still happens. It is a lot worse when you turn around and you're like, you know, John, what were you doing? And John's like, I don't know, the same thing I make up every time. Yeah, right. For that. It's a lot that soul searching. It's a lot harder to sleep at night when that happens to you. So putting together those good processes, following the news, even though that can sometimes be a little bit disheartening, but reading about some of the issues that are facing similarly situated businesses or high net worth individuals to you, and thinking about how to not have to learn about fraud after it happens to you,
right,
but maybe learn from where it's happening elsewhere and starting to put those programs in place, updating your cybersecurity needs, or working with your wealth manager, right? A lot of these companies are now extending the fence out from their cyber network at the investment manager to the actual family offices they're working with, sure, right? Offering sure those cybersecurity services or hosting all of that data and information is something that these wealth managers are doing. And firms like RSM are helping to collaborate and consult on that as well to make sure everyone's getting the best value and also feeling pretty good about what they're doing.
And of course, listening to podcasts like this and subscribing to Insecurities, which is your podcast, where
that's right,
you're learning a hell of a lot about this type of stuff. And you may get to see more of Vader the dog, who's nicely asleep over your left shoulder.
It's uncanny. The afternoon, she gets a little bit more involved in some of the Zoom calls. But right, for those right of you interested in the U.S. securities and regulatory enforcement world, as well as some international issues, check out the Insecurities podcast from the Practicing Law Institute, PLI. You can find us at pli.edu/insecurities. Darren, we think it's pretty funny that we talk about securities and we're a little insecure. That's where my co-host Kurt Wolf came up with the name, and we've been having a great time with it.
It's a great name. Fantastic.
Awesome.
All right, Chris, that's been amazing. Thank you very, very much for being on Definitely Uncertain, and really appreciate all your input.
Thanks so much. Have a great day, Darren.
Okay, and thanks everybody for watching. Bye-bye.